I joke about pandas. All right, so I'll just give a little introduction. So I told you what I do, that I coach rabbits. And it's pretty amazing that I'm zeichet to do that, because I wasn't born Jewish. I became Jewish when I was 16. I'm a 13th generation American. My family came in 1634 from England. So I actually have things in my house that are from the 1800s and even the 1700s that I'll be able to pass on to my children that belong to their great-great-great-grandparents. My family came to Raleigh, Massachusetts when they came from England and then pioneered out west to Michigan when Michigan was west. And cleared some of the land in Michigan and then eventually settled in Wisconsin, which is where I was born, in Madison, Wisconsin. And then lots of journeys from there. I can't even imagine what it's like to have a friend from childhood, somebody you know from 5 years old or whatever it is, which I'm sure many of you have if you're born and bred in Brooklyn, that you know people from kindergarten, but it's beyond my imagination. Because from Wisconsin we moved to, my father was finishing graduate school, his PhD in history, moved to Plattsburgh, New York, and Ithaca, New York, and Washington, D.C., and then settled in Rochester, New York, where he was a professor. And then he didn't get tenure, so in 1974, we took a trip around the country for a year doing research. It was a family field study in interracial neighborhoods and desegregated housing. They were totally into the whole racial integration thing. Then they came back, wrote a book together, and then got divorced. And then both my parents moved out to Portland, Oregon, which is where I spent my early teenage years, my atheistic period and my searching period. And then at 14, I had sort of like a mystical experience, sort of encounter with God, and decided that maybe I'm not an atheist, maybe I just didn't believe in what I was taught when I was raised.
What happened?
It was actually from a psychic healing workshop. And so it was a whole like chakra exchange of energy, and I felt like something, and I wasn't sure what that was. So I decided I should explore it. And I did. And I had been taught, my parents were not very strongly religious, but they believed in a higher power, and they believed that all religions were pretty much the same, just different meaning. So that's what they taught me. All religions are paths to the same destination. And so I just thought I should pick the path that I want to walk on. So I started looking for a path that was comfortable for me. So as a freshman in high school, I started reading books. I went down to the religion section in my inner city, mostly black performing arts high school, where I was a ballet student in musical theater. And I read across the bookshelf of different religions, and I found the book To Be a Jew. This is 1978, before Art Scroll. At that time, you're all too young to remember. Who's born before 1980 in this room? Before 19. Who's born after 1980? So any who's raising their hands right now, I've been Jewish longer than you, just letting you know that. So. Anyway, it's hard to remember those early days before Art Scroll and before nice bookstores. And it used to be, if you wanted a safer, you went into a farm store, you had to tell the person what book you wanted, they went over and found it for you and blew the dust off the top of it and sold it to you. And they didn't have gorgeous stores with like gifts and Judaica and books that are so inviting and magazines, and didn't have any of that stuff back in the day when long distance calls cost a lot of money, if you remember back then. Anyway, I found the book To Be a Jew, which Hashem put on that bookshelf just for me. I read it and I said, this is totally it. I totally felt like I slid into home plate. I didn't know any Jews at the time, but I just started keeping it as much as I could. So that's not the story I'm going to tell you tonight, but that's just a little background. 16, I converted. 16 and a half, I went to Israel. I re-dipped just to make sure it was good in Israel, too. And I spent 2 years learning in yeshiva in Israel, and then 2 years serving in the army in Israel, in Nachal. Back in the day, this was also in ancient history, when settlers were heroes, there was a day, and settlements were a good thing and a project of the government. So my part of the army, Nachal, is Noar Chalutz Lochem, young pioneering warriors. And it was our job to set up settlements. So that's what I did, which was hard at that time, and the army was much more sexist, and girls couldn't do a lot of things they can do today. So it was the closest a girl might get to battle, because you might be attacked in the settlement. So we had a 2-month basic training instead of a 3-week basic training. We learned 3 guns instead of 1 gun, a Uzi M16 and a Galil. Each girl was issued a Uzi, which is a girl gun, it turns out. Because you just spray from the waist, you don't aim that. I learned how to get out of shooting practice, because when you shoot your gun, it gets dirty, and you have to clean it and pass inspection. If you skip practice and work in the kitchen that day, your gun stays clean. So I learned all the tricks. Anyway, then when I went to Israel at 16, I really wanted to be a rabbi. And then I realized I was too frumped to be a rabbi. So I settled on just wanting to be a Torah teacher. And then I realized, how could I ever be a Torah teacher? It takes forever to learn all the stuff you need to know. I'll never know all that stuff. And so I just settled into being a passionate Jew and mom of many, got married, met my husband at 19, got married at 21, had 6 kids in 7.5 years, lived in Long Island. He commuted to the city. And we had that life until one day I said, this is not a life that I want to live anyway. I'll just tell you one experience I had and why we moved from Long Island to Denver. But I was in the back room at Moments one day, one of many experiences, but this is one, looking for a dress for somebody's simcha. And I thought, I stepped back from it, and I thought, look at all of us. We're all buying costumes to be props at each other's parties. Like, what am I, that's not the life I want to live. So that was just one experience of thinking about the level of materialism. Like, do I want, don't I want, do I want it for my kids, and do I want it for my husband? And he had just turned 40, and he was commuting into the city, leaving the house at 6 a.m. and coming back at midnight, and sliding in right before candlelighting, and sometimes leaving Motzei Shabbos. And I was like, and I saw the 50-year-olds in his firm were doing the same thing, and the pushing 60s were doing the same thing. And I thought, that's not the life I want to have. I want to have a husband and a father that knows the children, and I want to have children that know each other. And if we're supposed to be an Orla Goyim, then we probably should know some Goyim besides their grandmother. I'll tell you one, you have kids with slightly red hair. My husband has brown eyes. I have blue eyes. We have 5 blue-eyed children and 1 Hazel. Right, so the 1 Hazel-eyed daughter, one day at about 4, realized she doesn't have eyes like anybody in the family. She doesn't match anyone. But she asked me, where does it come from? And I knew where it came from. So she said, look, why don't I have eyes that go with anybody in the family? I said, oh, you do. You have Hazel eyes, just like Grandma Orly, my mother. And just like Aunt Shanna, my sister. So she looked at me and she said, do any Jews have Hazel eyes? So I took her to shul and showed her everybody that had green or Hazel or very light brown, anything that could pass so she would feel like she belongs. Okay, so in all of that, I certainly learned and grew quite a bit and continued learning and growing, and I love to learn Torah and learned regularly in Chavrusa and started to teach a class in Long Beach and learned about this concept of being Meshamesh Talmid Chacham, which, again, in the olden days, all the biographies they had were only men, right? There was nothing you could read about a woman. So I read tons of stuff about men, and I got very inspired, and now I'm going to dab my tikkun katzot every night, and then I thought, well, maybe I should start a shachar on a regular basis, add in mincha, get to marim, and maybe I'll think about tikkun katzot. But I was very inspired about the being Meshamesh Talmid Chacham concept, and I didn't know how I could do that. But then I met Tila Yeager, and she gave a shiur in Long Beach regularly, and she doesn't drive, so I pardon? Anyway, I started to drive her back and forth to Long Beach, so I got to spend more time with her. And that was my shimush period. And I sort of haredified through my relationship with her. I went from Mizrahi to Haredi that way. And continued learning and teaching, and moved to Denver and became a Kiruv professional and worked for Partners in Torah, and then started... And then I started doing this work that I do now, based out of Israel, where I am privileged to have a serious travel budget, where I travel and visit different rabbis across the country and get paid for coaching them. And I sometimes feel like I'm living a charmed life. Like, this is the life that I wanted to be, somebody who teaches and guides and shares Torah and inspires, and I never thought I could ever. And yet, somehow I'm here, which is amazing to me. Last year for Yom Kippur, I was in Dallas, and I was teaching. They I've gone to a lot of different congregations where I've done the instead of davening classes for those people who want to come but don't connect to the tefillahs. So I'm in Kippur. In Dallas, they actually have it different. They have a staff davening from 6 to 10:30, and then a learner service. So that's for Rosh Hashanah. So that's nice to get all your davening really quick, early. And then they have a learner service where they just have classes and teaching. So I did that, and they asked me to come back for Yom Kippur. I went for Yom Kippur, and I told everybody the story of Elazar ben Dodaya. Everybody knows that story, right? I'm not going to go into the story, but I'll tell you the point of that story, is that in order to tell the story on Yom Kippur, I wanted to look it up and make sure I had it right. So I didn't know exactly where it was in the Gemara, but I asked the rabbi who was hosting me there, where will I find it? And he gave me a sefer that had the whole story quoted and something else in Hebrew. So I read those few pages just to make sure I was right, but I brought the book with me up to the class, to teach the class. 60 people, 100, probably 100 people already in the middle of Yom Kippur, and telling them about how they can be kind of olamo b'sha'a achas. And then I just picked up the book. I said, I just want you to know that I reviewed it from this book. It's all in Hebrew with no vowels. And I read it myself. There's nobody in this room who started with less Jewish knowledge than I did. Nobody in this room, and nobody in that room either who started with less. And everybody could get there if they so choose. Everybody could make it a goal to learn more and grow more. I spoke to a mother recently who said that she has a teenager with questions. Many people, themselves included, have questions. How do I know this is true? How do I know that is true? How can I explain it to my daughter? How can I explain to my son his question? What should I do? So what I would say is learn. Take the time. It's great to be inspired, but also take the time to learn more. Because a lot of us leave our Judaism in the early stages. You went to Beis Yaakov, you learned whatever you learned, and now, how does it really connect? Is it true that if you dip the apple in the honey, you're going to have a sweet year? What about having a fish head on your table, right? Is it true that it's going to make a difference or not? Will you really be the Rosh Hashanah Zanav? What if you're feeling very Zanavdic? You know, I want this one to the actual fish head because it's a little creepy. Now I can do it because I have a son-in-law who insists. But for many years, I bought the candy fish, and I cut off all the heads, and I served a little dish of the heads. But the kids were in the kitchen eating all the tails. So that means they have more of a tail kind of a year. Who knows? But I did have fun with the guests because I served all the same money first, and I kept the fish heads in the kitchen, and I would tell them that we're very machped in our house. Everybody has their own fish head, and we require all of our guests to eat it, actually. So, but since it's so many fish heads, I won't be bringing it up until the end of the simanim. So I get a good laugh when I bring out the candy fish heads. Alright, so anyway, it is important to learn more than minhagim to pass on. Now I just want to give you one insight that I have. It took me a while to get to this insight. Sometimes we rest in a minhag or in an older understanding of something, and we don't grow through it, and it works for us. And it's okay, because that's the way your mother understood it, that's the way your grandmother understood it, that's the way your great-grandmother understood it. And it gets passed on, but at some point it could not be passed. So it pays to learn something more. But I had insight into the value of minhagim as a gerut or a bal tshuva, if anybody is bal tshuva. Any bali tshuva pick and choose different minhagim. And I had a hard time understanding why people care so much about a particular minhag. I mean, you're supposed to have them, right? But what happens if you don't do a certain minhag? Not the minhag kedin type of minhag, but the minhag that's family-ish, right? So my daughter's engaged, and the girl across the street is engaged, right? So the girl across the street is from a very hush of family. Sperm-writing kind of a family, you know, deep, deep, deep family. Yekish. Right, so she comes across the street, and my daughter had told me she wants a deck tichel for her wedding, no problem. I made her a thicker veil, goes with her dress. And Sephora comes across the street and says, "Oh, I want one of those for my wedding too." I said, "No problem, you can borrow Sarah's, or if the white doesn't match your dress, I'll make you one that matches." She said, "Oh no, I'm not allowed. It's not our minhag." And you know what you get when you spell minhag backwards, right? That's right, Gehenna. Right? You speak backwards, so you know.
Don't worry, I had it in my head.
So she was really serious about it. Like, no, she can't. I'm thinking, really? A girl wants to be able to walk. A little more tznius, actually, that she should be able to cry or daven and not have everybody stare at her on her way to the chuppah. And her parents are telling her, absolutely not. Why? And yet they were very clear about it. So I thought about it for a few years, and I finally realized I have a bunch of stuff I can give to my kids that belonged to their grandparents and great-grandparents and great-grandparents. I have a dresser that went across country and covered a wagon from the early 1800s. I have a few things from the 1700s. And I can give it to them unchanged, except for whatever ruining I've done in my tenure owning it. And it's theirs. But most Jews don't have stuff that's that old, except for minhagim. And if you change your minhag, it's not your family's Yerusha anymore, right? If that's what belongs to your family. So if your grandfather did it that way and your great-grandfather did it that way, and then you change it, you're not giving your great-grandfather's thing to your children. You're giving something else. So I got a lot of insight into what it is to pass on something to keep us connected. Now, that being said, sometimes people pass on things that don't keep them connected. Like, for instance, I was just speaking to Rabbi Pelty in Mexico, where I was for Rosh Hashanah, and he's the junior rabbi, his father's a senior rabbi, of the Turkish synagogue there. They have a very strong Chazanut tradition, and the Jews from Turkey learned how to daven in a Turkish way, and they're very careful. It's very important to them that they have that special Chazanut, and that and they have their special foods, and they have their special way of davening. That's what they learned, and that's it. They didn't learn. They weren't Shomer Shabbos. They weren't always Shomer Kashrus. They didn't learn the halachas of pretty much anything else. But davening, if you don't daven like that, you're not Turkish. So they really daven like that. But sometimes we grasp onto things and pass them on, and they're not really the depth of it. So I will say that as somebody who came to Judaism on purpose, while on the one hand I don't have roots, on the other hand I don't have the baggage, and I'm able to sometimes see things and share some of those things that can help help hopefully shift perspectives. Okay, that being said, let's talk about difficult things and how to get through difficult things. Like what this is a very special week. I don't know if you're aware. Of course, you're aware that it's a Seret Yom HaTshuvah, but we have 7 days in the middle, in between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Those 7 days are parallel to, each one is parallel to a day of the week of the previous year and parallel to a day of the week in the coming year. So it's actually a week in which we're gestating our new selves. It's like a pregnancy week. And just like when we're pregnant, we're careful to eat appropriately and refrain from damaging activities, things that we might do. You're not going to do a ropes course when you're pregnant, right? But and you are going to take prenatal vitamins when you're pregnant. And you're probably not going to take vitamins every day on the day that you're not pregnant. And you might do a ropes course or drink wine or, God forbid, even smoke a cigarette, right? Things that we don't do when we're pregnant. Anyway, so this is a special week where we want to both refrain from and invest in the new self that we're gestating. And each day parallels in both directions. So today is already Thursday night, right? Just kidding. It's Thursday. I mean the night of Thursday day. That's what I meant. So we're in Thursday already. So I think, right? It's dark enough. We're in Thursday. So right now, it's Yom Chamishi. Right, so this Yom Chamishi, this Thursday, is now paralleling all the Thursdays of the previous year. So we can do tshuva on this day for all the Thursdays of the previous year, and we can invest in this day for all the, we can create DNA for all the coming Thursdays of the year ahead. So let's just say you're somebody like me, age 49, who set a wish for herself that by 50 you want to be in the Chatzot Club, make Shabbos by Chatzot. Is a wish that I have. So that means that this Friday, especially because it's the year that I'm going to turn 50 in, I'm going to be super careful to have Shabbos ready on time, Bezrat Hashem. Because I want to make sure that this Friday is invested with the energy of being really on time, really early, because I know that it's a special week that I can invest in very carefully. So some people take on extra things during this week, whether it's extra levels of kashrus or tznius, or not becoming angry, something like that. You just make a decision that this whole week I will invest in a peaceful year by absolutely not losing my temper, period, end of discussion, this week. So I know it's late in the week to let you know that little secret, but still.
Like, where were you Sunday?
Still, sorry. You'll know for next year, but you can still do it this year. So this is a very special week to work on investing and shifting and changing until we get to Yom Kippur. It doesn't mean that you don't have power to change things anyway before, but you have extra power. Each day is connected to those days, both backwards and forwards. Okay, so but what is really our goal? Why are we here? Why are we Jewish women? Why are we Jews all together? Why do we have the Torah? Like, why are we in a physical world? What's the story? Come on, you guys, you should answer. What is the purpose of life? Why? God needs our service? Really, just think about it. Does God need our service? He doesn't, right? God was God before everything. It's going to be God after everything. He doesn't really need us. We don't change his reality. So he for sure doesn't need a bunch of servants.
Why did he anoint us?
Huh?
Why did he anoint us?
Why did he anoint us? Good question. Keep that question.
God is giving us a chance.
Good, but why should we be like God?
We have to be on the Shema that is part of God. So us emulating him, we're a piece of him, so it gives him pleasure when we are growing and connecting with him.
Good. Excellent. Who else?
Yeah. Well, how are we supposed to be like glorifying Hashem in this world? Now I heard this to be bringing Hashem and we might have glorified him.
Yep. And what else? What about Olam Haba?
To get it.
To get it? What is Olam Haba?
Well, it says, I think it's just a shrine, but the point of our existence here is to gain Olam Haba.
Good. Okay, so all of these things, that really is the end. All of these things that you mentioned so far are the means, right? There's a means to a goal, but the goal is Olam Haba, but Olam Haba not just by itself. What is Olam Haba? Do we believe in heaven and hell? Is that where we're headed, one place or the other? What's up with that? What is Olam Haba?
It's only truth. It's only truth. There's nothing wrong in it. And we see God pure and real.
Good. What else?
We're here to get the ultimate pleasure.
Good. What is the ultimate pleasure?
By working on ourselves as people. By working on our egos. By working on who we are. That is ultimate pleasure.
Well, that's the means.
Tikkun
HaMidos is how we do it. What is the ultimate pleasure? Good, thank you. Good, that is what it is. Because God doesn't need us, right? He doesn't need us to serve him. We don't fix the world. We don't make it. He can make the world however he wants it. He chose to make the world broken so that we could fix it, so that we could acquire Olam Haba, so that we could praise Hashem, so that we could fix our midos, so that we could be close to him. Because the more that we emulate Hashem, the stronger relationship we can have with Hashem. The closer Hashem starts us off, B'Tzelem Elohim, in Hashem's image, but then it's up to us to cultivate that. So the more we walk in Hashem's ways, the more we, B'Halachta B'Drachav, do what Hashem said to do, right, or act like Hashem acts, the closer we are, the more we transform ourselves into somebody that can have a very strong relationship with Hashem. Hashem wants to give us the best, right? So what is the best thing that we could get? Yeah, that's really Hashem. There's nothing better than Hashem, right? There's nice clothes, there's beautiful homes, there's cars, there's nachas from the children, there's loving marriages, there's a peaceful world. But above all that, really better than any of that, is Hashem. Hashem wants to give Hashem's self to us. So the vehicle of giving one's self is through relationship. So Hashem is all there in the relationship, and we're the lowest common denominator, right? The level of our relationship is completely dependent on how we behave. Right? It could be a close relationship, it could be a distant relationship. It's up to us. Right? So Hashem is there to be as close as we want. It's up to us to step in or out. Completely up to us. So we have all these different ways, but Hashem wants us to be closer. Let's just think for a second. Who has their kids playing piano? You do? I mean, who's paying for music lessons for their kids of any kind? Okay, right. Why? Because you want them to learn to play, right? They want to learn to play? So you're willing to spend money and pack their time. They should practice, right? And listen to the miserable sounds that they make at first. Right? Why? Because in the end, you want them to have a gift that they can only acquire through their hard work. You can't buy it for them. Cannot, no matter how much money you have, you cannot buy the skill of playing the piano for somebody else. You can buy them lessons, you can give them a piano, you can push them to do it, but the only way you can acquire the skill is actually sitting down and working on it. So Hashem, in a way, is like the mother that pays for piano lessons for us. Right? So the mom says, I'll give you the lessons, and I'm going to tell you it's time to come practice. Why do I want you to come practice right now? A, because I said so. But B, really, because I want you to have that gift that you can only give yourself. So Hashem says, do something, because I said so. But really, because I want you to be in a relationship with me that only you can cultivate. There's no way to have a relationship without you making it. So that's all the service of Hashem is all about, cultivating ourselves into that relationship. So Hashem sets us up. Right? He gives us our life, he gives us our sensory, he gives us our bodies, he gives us our brains, he gives us our husbands, he gives us our children. Right? I don't know about you, but there are some children that are harder than others, some children are easier than others. Right? Some children are, I have one child who, my first one, which I'm tricked me with her, totally, gave me her, and I said, don't you want to punish it with me? She said, yes I do, in fact I do. So that's why I had so many children quickly, and it turns out none of the rest of them. None. But each one of them is helping me grow in different ways. Right? And I did set a goal earlier in my life. I want to be the strongest. I want to be as, once I decided I wanted to be Jewish, I said, I want to be as Jewish as I can be. So I want to be Jewish as I can be. I want to be a Jewish teacher. I want to be a Jewish educator. More than that, I want to be a vessel for shining the aura of Hashem in the world. Right? When I daven, when I learn Torah, first of all, I tell Hashem, I totally don't have enough time to learn. And I don't have a good enough memory to remember it. So I'm just relying on you, Hashem. Please, chanein hadat, give me knowledge for free. And please help me remember it. And please help me understand it. And please help me live it. And please help me shine it. That's my tefillah. That it should be not just something I learn and remember and grow through, but it should become integrated into me and shine out of me. That's what I want. I want to be an example that when people say, look at her, they say, what makes her like that? Torah makes her like that. Oh, really? Torah makes her like that? I'm curious about it. What could you teach me about the Torah that makes you like that? So, which is really Hashem's Kiruv plan. Right? It's not Eshet Torah. And it's not all the other seminaries, whatever, it's not Neve. Really, Hashem's Kiruv plan is each one of you. Right? Each one of you in your marriages, in your homes, in your businesses, in your neighborhoods. They should shine so brightly that people look at you and say, what makes you like that? How could I have that? There's just two couples that converted in Seattle, Washington, converted just because of that. Two black couples. So one of the men watched all the fathers on Shabbos walk with their children to shul. And he lived in the neighborhood and he thought, I want a family like that, where the father's with the children and the children care about being with the father. How will I get a family like that? So he spoke to his new wife and they agreed to explore Judaism. His new wife's sister was dating somebody else. After they explored Judaism, a little bit. She told her sister about it. Her sister was interested, and her sister's boyfriend is interested. And the four of them converted to Judaism and are part of the Seattle Jewish community now. But because of the shining of this Seattle community, that they shined out, and people said, I want a family like that. I want a marriage like that. I want community support like that. I want the stability that's offered there. Sometimes we don't know how special what we have is. And we are largely disconnected today. I see that we have pretty serious problems with actually understanding what Judaism is about. A lot of people are holding on to external trappings instead of filling themselves up with really what it's about. But Hashem provides us with opportunities for that too. So, the first X extra challenge that I got. Was a child with pretty serious ADD. Sorry, anybody who has to leave, please leave. I had a child with pretty serious ADD who was all over the place, all the time. Never stopping, always moving. So I spoke to Rebs Yeager about it. I said, what should I do? She said, it's a test. So I'm like, okay, it's a test. Okay. Then my father came to visit, and he saw this kid everywhere. He's like, what is going on with this child? He said, it's a test. He said, really, what do you get if you pass the test? I said, I don't know. So I had to learn more about what is a test, right? What do you get if you pass the test? And it took me a lot of years to realize there's no passing or not passing a test. What do you get if you move through that nisayon? You get a bigger you. You get a more capacious you. You get a you that can hold more Hashem because you've transformed through the experience. So I learned from her, step into it instead of stepping away from it, right, and grow through it. It's a challenge. But the whole point of the challenge is to become more than you were before. That's what the Nisayon's about. Right? So Hashem's, I think about them now as workshops. Right? It's a workshop for growth. Hashem signs you up for that workshop. Sometimes Hashem lovingly custom designs a workshop for you, signs you up for it, and then offers it to you, and you say, actually, you know, thank you. I'd rather not have that workshop. And Hashem says, actually, yes. I choose that you take this workshop. Not really an option. I see potential in you, and I would like to help bring it out. Right? When I was in high school, I told you I took ballet. So I had a very classical ballet teacher. She was very full of herself, as good ballet teachers must be. So she walked around with a stick that she could whack people with. So, you know, you're standing there at the bar, so if you're standing like this, no problem. But if you're standing like this, whack with a stick to get your elbow up, whack with a stick to get your shoulders down, whack with a stick to get your tush in, whack with a stick to get your hand, like, she's all over, right? So she'd walk around the class and whacking people. One day we had a relatively new girl in the class, and this teacher was all over her. Usually you just get hit once or twice in a class, but she was just all over her, hitting her. Finally the girl started to cry. Broke it. You're always hitting me. It's not fair. So she stopped the music. Then she came over to her and she said, don't you cry when I correct you. I correct you because I see potential. You cry the day I stop. And then she started the music again. So that was an experience I had, a real story that happened when I was 16. And I thought about it later on when I learned Mizmor LaDavid. Right? Your rod and your staff are both a comfort for me. So a shepherd has one stick. It's the same stick. And he uses it as a staff to go up the mountain. And he also uses it to keep the sheep in line. You see a sheep straying, he just gives them a little whack to get them back into place, right? So it's both a supportive stick and a whacking stick. So Hashem has that same stick for us to support us or to give us a little whack here and there to bring us into the place He wants us to be. And we say to Hashem, both of them are a comfort because both of them mean you care about me. Whether you're supporting me or reprimanding me, whether you're pushing me hard or pushing me gently, both of them are indications that you care about my growth, you care about my placement, you care about who I am. So I learned to see even extremely difficult workshops as custom designed with love by Hashem to help me grow at the stage that I'm at. So I started with the ADD kid, then I moved through him. Now he runs a jewelry store successfully, and it's the greatest quality on the planet to be able to be everywhere all the time, right? So, he runs a jewelry store. So he's fabulous. He dresses. I tell him, Avi, your suit looks great. He's like, I make this suit look good. I'm like, yes, you do. It is so much fun to have grown kids. I can't even tell you. It's so worth it to have little kids and go through all that because it's great. You know, they say that when your kids are little, they're so yummy you could eat them up. And when they're teenagers, you wish you had. But if you can wait till after they're teenagers, you're really glad you didn't. Because they're super fun once they're like in their early 20s. I love it. So he did make it. It was a miracle that both of us made it through his childhood. And now he's doing great. And after him, as he started to calm down a little bit, or at least figure it out, so then I had one with pretty serious depression and anger issues. And I'm trying to remember. He was a very sharp kid. At the age of four, he used to say, Ema, can I sleep in your quarters tonight? And at five, he said, right, these are my olden days. Well, I had to think of that one for a minute, right? Because he's thinking ahead to when he's going to be thinking back. That at five, it's the olden days of then. Right? At seven, he put a note on the fridge that said, danger, don't go to the library. So I it was unsigned. I went and found him. I was like, what's the danger of going to the library? He's like, have you seen our library? It's a library, but it's Long Beach, Long Island. It's a library, let's say, about three times the size of this house, but with the children's room being about the size of the main floor. I said, have you seen that library? I said, yes, I have. I said, well, this is how it works. First, you learn how to read. Then you love reading. Then you read all the books, and then you're bored for the rest of your life. So that's at seven, right? So I had to take him to the New York Public Library, the big one downtown, and say, look, you're never, ever going to run out of books. It's really not a danger. Just keep on reading. Like, you'll never, ever have that problem. Maybe some others, but not that one. So, and then I figured him out, although still working with him. He just got his MCAT scores cracked on. He's doing nicely and applying for med school now. And then up came the next one. Oh, it was a super challenge. Well, some of you have read about him, so I'll just share with you. I was very thankful. Okay, I'll tell you that. So I really feel like each one of those workshops in those children, and along the way, of course, other workshops, children with learning issues, which is why we ended up moving to Denver and not to Israel, because even though I wanted out of the New York scene, and I wanted to go back to Israel, I had children with learning issues that were too serious to go to Israel. We had to go somewhere else. So children with learning issues, children with health issues. I'll just retell a quick story of the same one who was such a pikeach. So he had asthma. He's a second twin. And second twins often have something up, apparently, from what I heard. Anyway, he's a second twin. And he had asthma, and like every other week I had to take him to the doctor for whatever respiratory stuff was going on with him. And they always wrote his name at the top of the page, you know, and I would take it back to the nurse and give it to her, and they'd make a new appointment. And then one day, his sister, Sarah, his twin sister Sarah, was sick. I brought her in, examined her, gave me a piece of paper, and I didn't write her name on top of it. I thought, that's weird. They always write his name. How come they're not writing her name? So I asked them, how come you always write Uri's name on the top of his paper, and you didn't write Sarah's? They said, oh, that's not his name. URI is upper respiratory infection. I was thinking, what did I name my child? and I had to learn, I don't know if anybody's experienced nebulizers, I had to learn how to nebulize him, how to like hold him tight and put that mask on him, and as he like tried to get away from it and whatever. So I had a lot of workshops along the way. But then, I think it was to help me with many things, and also for my youngest, who was a super challenge. First of all, he was the prince. Born, you know, the youngest and blonde and blue and gorgeous and friendly, and everybody, I mean, he was, everybody knows what having a princess in their family, right? Or they've seen families, and he was loved by everyone, even though he wasn't so distant from the youngest above him, but he was literally the prince of the family. And he and I were very close when he was little. I would take him with me to volunteer in all the schools. And then, starting at about age five, he told me that he did not want to be here anymore. He didn't want to be in this world. He said, Ema, I just want to walk into the ocean and keep on going. Or, I just want to walk into traffic. You know, at five. Right? And so I started to talk to him about it. He said, and he would regularly tell me, I didn't ask to come here, and I don't want to stay. And anytime there's any kind of challenge with him, he would say, it's your fault. You're the one who conceived me. You're the one who brought me into this world. I didn't ask to come. It's not my job. And what can we answer that? Really, the truth is, and sometimes as he grew a little bit older, he would even say, you know, you were selfish. You wanted to have another kid. But nobody asked me if I wanted to be that kid. Not that he didn't love us. He did not want to be on the planet at all. So, of course, I took him to doctors. We started medication for depression at age 7. And as he grew, he became a little bit quirky. He wasn't really quirky when he was born. He became a little quirkier as he got older. Had a hard time in school, and he was super smart. It's only through him that I had kids with learning disabilities, but I learned through him the definition of a learning disability, a 30-point distance between IQ and ability to manifest it. And then I learned about him also the definition of twice exceptional. So you're exceptional if you can't manifest your IQ. That's an exception to the rule. Most people can, right? But if you have a very high IQ and you can't manifest it, that's two exceptions. Or if you have a very low IQ. He had a very high IQ, and he couldn't manifest at his IQ level. So he manifested regular, but really he was very bright. So his teachers all thought he was lazy. So he had a hard time in school because everybody branded him as lazy. And he would cry. He would say, look, why should I do my homework? I'm just going to be dead tomorrow anyway. Why should I brush my teeth? I'm just going to be dead tomorrow anyway. I told him, just brush your teeth so the worms will have less to eat. Like, it got to be such a regular conversation that I had to just, like, be straight up about it. And anyway, he went through school, and he was very clear that he did not want to stay. And it was hard being with that. Sometimes he started to evolve into some anger problems and more depression problems, and then good times, and then he became a computer genius. And really grew in his computer ability, but was really clear that nobody could touch his computer. I mean, not. And I became scared for the safety of the other kids, certainly for the grandkids. Like, if somebody would touch something or knock something over, you couldn't even put, like, if he got mail, you couldn't even put his letter on his keyboard because nobody could touch his computer, and it was scary. So there were times that I was worried for the health and safety of other people in the household. And then he started to stay up late, long hours, and not need any sleep. Finally, we switched psychiatrists, and I found out these are all signs of, anybody know? Bipolar disorder, not just depression. And nobody looked for it before. First of all, you can't see it so young, but second of all, it's only relatively recently that anybody even believes that kids could have it. So, but it was the long nights and the very little need for sleep and the high energy and the extra brilliance and it turns out he also had Asperger's, so he was very literal on things. He really held people to the truth and to the literal meaning of things. Like, as he started smarting computers in 7th grade, he had an assignment to make a PowerPoint presentation. How you feel about school? That was a dangerous assignment for him. And so he actually made one about how he felt about school. It was called The Vortex of Swirling Evil, was the title of his presentation. So he completed it, and of course the teacher said, who wants to share their PowerPoint presentation? So he was ready, and he got to it, and he talked about the vortex of swirling evil and how he wishes he was dead, and he wishes his teachers were dead, and they didn't even let him finish. Right? Right away he's in the office, and I'm called down to the office, and like, you know, he's thrown out of school in Colorado. There's this whole Columbine thing of kids killing teachers, and like everybody's all nervous. And I had to take him to the psychiatrist and get him recertified and sent back to school. It was like pretty hard. All this time I'm working with, this is a workshop. Shep loves me. I could for sure do this. I'm not big enough to do this, but I could grow through this. Like, I really, a lot of davening, and Shem was my best friend in this. You can't really tell even your close friends that your kid is a maniac. And that you're nervous, that you love him, and you're worried that you shouldn't be killed by him. Like, how do you live with that? Like, loving somebody and worrying, should I keep knives in the kitchen or not keep knives in the kitchen? Like, what will happen? Can you leave the kids alone or not leave the kids alone? You know, like, it's a petrifying thing to, like, worry about. So it's not something I really shared with a lot of people. Anyway, we did have a very difficult situation one night where I had spoken to a psychiatrist before, and he said, if that happens again, would you consider calling the police? So we just talked about what it would be to call the police, and I decided that I would be willing to, especially because in the news was an Asperger's computer genius kid who had hacked into the Pentagon, and they were trying to extradite him from England to prosecute him here. And I was thinking, I really want to establish that my kid is crazy before he gets, like, arrested for hacking, because I already knew that he was setting up proxy websites to allow the Chinese dissidents to speak without censorship. And he had one in Iran, too, so that people could communicate without the government censorship. That was his tzedakah in the world, was setting up websites that dissidents could speak outside of censorship. Every time the police car slowed down in front of my front house, I was like, oh, it's not the Chinese police coming for my son. But it wasn't. Anyway, I did end up calling the police one time when he was hospitalized. And they quickly brought him back to a nice equilibrium, and then he told me, like, while he was in the hospital, every day, twice a day, they'd ask him questions, do you hear any voices? How are you doing? So when they would say, do you hear any voices? He said, no, I don't, and neither do I. Like Donnie. When he came home from the hospital, of course he ate the hospital food, he asked for ranch salad dressing. So I bought him ranch dressing, he took it out of the fridge one day, he said, you know, Ima, I never tried ranch dressing until I was in the hospital, and now I'm crazy about it. So he had a good sense of humor about what was going on with him. Then he graduated high school, and then he told me, I still don't want to be here. I was like, you're so brilliant. Let's start college. That's a computer degree. He needed time off. Started the little college. He was about to end. Anyway, to make a long, long story short, his dream came true in May, and he actually did take his life in May. He talked to me about it a lot before. He even asked me, what's my preferred method? I said, I am going to do it. And he talked to me about it over the years, but he told me, I am going to do it. Tell me, what's your preferred method? What could a mother say to that old age? That's my preferred method. And we talked a lot. I said, tell me a reason to live. Why should I stay here? And we looked up. He was not observant. He was not religious. He didn't believe in God. So what could I tell him? Nothing from the Torah could help. Nothing. So we looked up reasons to live on the internet, and we talked about it, and he said, none of it really. It didn't speak to him. I said, why should I stay here? Give me one good reason. He said, because we love you desperately, and we'll miss you so much if you leave. He said, what, so I should live in pain my entire life just to spare you the pain of burying me? So I said, yes, actually, that is how I feel. But that's not how he felt. So he did ask me my preferred method. I couldn't tell him preferred, but I did tell him my least preferred. I said, please don't shoot yourself. I can't bear to find that. And please don't hang yourself, because I don't want to see that either. I actually have one of the young Robinsons that I work with, middle-aged Robinson now. Her mother took her life, and she told me about it. She told me about it years ago, because it's something she was living with, but she told me about it now, that she actually found her mother and had to cut the rope herself. She called 911, and she is the one who had to cut her mother down. It's impossible to even imagine living with that. So instead, he took poison, which was pretty clean and pretty fast and very considerate. And I was thinking about it 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, when we learned in the parsha it was about Shiloh Hakan sending away the mother bird from the nest. So as I heard it, and the Rav like was speaking about how Hashem keeps his own mitzvahs, and I thought, I don't see Hashem really keeping this mitzvah. You know, like, I had to see my son die. You know, I mean, I didn't see him swallow the poison. He told me to go to bed, that it's, you know, I'm getting up early, I'm going to the wedding of my, you know, this new, I forgot to tell you guys, but we have an adopted Russian son. I was going to his wedding the next day. He said, you have to go to bed, you have to get some rest, it's time for you. And I was just finishing some last emails. And he said, you need your sleep. So I went to bed, and 10 minutes later, I heard a terrible noise, and flew downstairs, and he was dying. I called 911. They came, they worked on him for hours, brought him to the hospital, and he died a few hours later. So I thought, really, Hashem? Like, I saw him die. Is that right? Like, you're supposed to send away the mother before you take the children. And then I realized my son actually did send me away so he could take himself away. And then I thought, isn't the reward for that a long life? You know, there's all these paradoxes. And I think that it's okay to feel those paradoxes and to question what's up with Hashem's plan. One of my rabbis used to say, what's the difference between a Jew and God? God knows everything. And a Jew knows better. You know, we'd like to tell Hashem that we know better than him, and we know the plan better, and we know what should happen better. But the truth is, over the years, I've definitely learned Hashem does know better. It's really hard to bury a child. I can't even tell you what it was like at the end. I was petrified for so long that it would happen. Sorry. I didn't even realize how much I was waiting until the night after he died. And the night after he died, all the kids moved into the house for Shiva. Everybody's there. And I was in my bed, and I heard a noise, and I wasn't worried. And I didn't get up and go check it out. I knew it was one of the other kids who was going up the stairs or slammed a door, was getting something to eat or was whatever, and I didn't have to worry because it was done already. And I didn't have to jump up and go see what that was. And then I realized every night I was sleeping with my ears open, waiting to hear something. And I did regularly go downstairs to see just what was that noise. And I didn't have to worry. So it for sure was a nightmare sitting Shiva for your baby. And the second morning of Shiva, when we woke up, my husband looked at me and said, I'm dreading the day. And if Donnie felt like this every day, that when he woke up, I could understand better why he did it. And I thought about his comment during the day, because even when you're sitting there, of course you're crying. And you're also telling some stories of love and fun times that you had together. You might even laugh. And I was thinking about it. People brought us food. Of course, our house was inundated with food. And I remember, like, the first few days, I couldn't taste it at all. It didn't matter. But I noticed the day that I picked up the salt and put it on something. I thought, I tasted that. And it needs to be adjusted. That's why I put salt on it. And at the same time, I'm mourning my son. So there's like two different planes. Like you could have that terrible sadness and pull, and also ask somebody how they're doing, taste the food that you're eating, have a desire for something. And I thought maybe that's how he lived, because he seemed so happy. Like he really did have like a, he had a simple sahayim, except for he didn't. So it was definitely a workshop, raising him and burying him. And since we did adopt this Russian son, and we did get married the day that my son died, and we were planning on making Shem Brachas for him, so somebody else in the community made the Shem Brachas, but our Rav told us that we have to go to them Friday night. We did not go to the wedding. No, because he died that morning, and the wedding was in Muncie. I was on a plane that morning. They said I was in the hospital with my son. And we actually had to call people back from the airport because, you know, different kids were on their way to the airport. And we called some kids to come sit with us because we weren't sure yet if he would make it through. It's amazing how much I was so inspired when the paramedics came. I was like, okay, everything's going to be okay. They came. He's not dead yet. They intubated him. They put him in the ambulance, took him to the hospital. Like, okay, we're going to get past this. He'll probably try it again, but at least this one, it's not going to work, right? And they could not. He did his research. He took poison that worked very well, and they worked very, very hard on him, and they could not. But we did call, while we were waiting at first, we called some of the kids, and then we told, you know, some of the in-law kids they should still go to the wedding, because we didn't know, maybe he'd be in the hospital for a few days. And how could we, like, not send anybody from the family to our adopted son's wedding? And then we called them back from the airport. And then we had a funeral instead. Where was I going with that? Forgot. Oh, Shabbos. So our Rav said that Shabbos, Shiva, that you're not allowed to show outward signs of mourning. So we had to go to Shavuot because if we didn't, it would be clear that we're not because we're in mourning. So we had to go. So it was very stressful to go. You know, get up from Shiva, take a shower, light candles, go to Shiva Brachos. And I didn't even get to say the Yiratzon from lighting the candles, because as soon as I lit, there was a car accident in front of our house. and somebody was injured, not badly, but 911 had to be called, and there's like all this stuff going on. And then as soon as that was taken care of, off to Shadow Brothers. So I was like full of adrenaline and full, like no time to like just relax, talk to Hashem for a few minutes, you know, at the end of the Shiva week or before going to Shadow Brothers. So I just walked in numb to Shadow Brothers. And the hostess there is like, oh, Hashem, this, you know, she's like, this must be really hard for you. This must be the hardest thing you ever did. And I just nodded. I couldn't say anything because I couldn't talk. But later on in the evening, I thought, you know, burying my son was the saddest thing I ever did, but raising him was the hardest thing that I ever did. And it was, it's not one whole thing. It's day after day after day, and workshop after workshop after workshop, and doctor after teacher after playmate after sibling after parent after grandparent, and just dealing with each one of the phases and stages and working with the child and bringing them to a place. And then I think I was more prepared than anybody else in the family because he was so close with me and we talked a lot about it, but and then letting him go. I knew it was coming. For me, it was like a cancer death. You know, like somebody's sick and then they get better and then they're sick and then they get better and then they have a crisis and then you're not sure and then they die. So that's how I felt about it, but not everybody else felt that way because the siblings didn't know that he was so close. And my husband, I think, was in more denial. Who could live with that? Like, there's just different ways to live. I lived with it with humor and confronting it. You lived with it with denial and avoiding it. And anyway, we're working on the workshop of letting him go. And I have to say, even though he's not chayav for his suicide, halachically, and we spoke to the rabbi about it, and that's considered, his death was considered death from mental illness. It still was a comfort that he died before he was Bar Omshin, before he was 20. You know, that like just it's, you know, that at 20 you're extra high up for your avarice. So I was even though I was sad to lose him, it was a little comfort that he wasn't yet 20. That he passed before then. So I see it again as it's very hard, and I spoke to my husband about it, and he's the one actually who said that, you know, if Hashem would have come to us, when we said to ourselves, do we want another one? Should we have a sixth? Right? If Hashem would have said, you know what, I'll give you a sixth, but he's going to be mentally ill and he'll take his life at 19. Do you still want him? I think we both would have said, no, thank you. We'll stick with the five that we have. Right? But it wasn't an option. But now that we had him, we never would have traded him. There's no way. And we had enough good times with him that just that was worth it, but the growth that we had and the way that it affected our family and the way that it affected our community has really been a treasure, and I wouldn't trade it. And it's fascinating to me, so I'm doing some more reading now. I didn't read right away about suicide and mourning and grief and processing, but I'm doing some reading now, and many people that I read about say it's so hard because the community is so, has so much stigma, and people don't accept it, and people don't talk to you. And I actually listened to one like teleconference of a husband and wife who are, I think, either they're very religious Christians or they're ministers, but a mother who had lost her son in her 20s, in his 20s, said that it was so, they had a whole chapter in their teleconference about mean things or difficult things that people say. So she said one person came over to her and said, isn't it sad that your son did the one unpardonable sin and now he's going to be in hell forever? Even if you think that, could you say that to a mother who's mourning the loss of her son? So I think a lot of people have experienced things like that. I have to say, Baruch Hashem, we have not. Our community in Denver was so supportive. And our Rav came to us right after he died, and he said, you know, we can tell the community whatever you want. I'll work with you to be, you know, to have something to say. And I was like, both of us, absolutely not. Our son had mental illness, and now we can tell everybody, and he died of mental illness, he died at his own hand, and we want to be very clear. So many people suffer alone and in silence because they can't share it with anybody, and we have to know that that can be a way that Hashem makes a person. And it's just like dying from diabetes or cancer or anything else, that a body is created in a way that Hashem creates a body and a brain. And some illnesses, like bipolar disorder, can be fatal. Like cancer, not always fatal, but frequently fatal. Bipolar disorder is, anybody has that in their lives, could learn more about it, but there's about a 30% chance, usually about a 60% chance of trying, and a 30% chance of success, of ending one's life with bipolar disorder. Which doesn't mean that everybody who has it does it. They don't. So there's what to work with there. If you have it, or if you're married to somebody who has it, or if you're parenting somebody who has it, or if you're the child of somebody who has it, it's difficult to live with for sure, and it's a lovingly designed workshop by Hashem to bring you to the place that you need to come to. But it's all about soul transformation through the physical world that we live in. So there's what to learn about it and try to prevent, and also the acceptance of when somebody dies of their disease. So, let's just say one thing about Yom Kippur. Do you want to ask any questions before I go on? Shift to Yom Kippur mode?
You can.
Okay. Pardon? As somebody who came to Judaism, even though it was early in life, but later in life, by 16 I already really liked Stevie Wonder. So, since my son died, not quite 4 months.
Not yet 4 months.
On the 19th, it'll be 4 months. So there's a Stevie Wonder song that really played through my mind a lot. It's called Go Have a Talk with God. So I just like it would just regularly play there. There's a free psychiatrist that's known throughout the world, solving the problems of all men, little boys and girls. When you feel your life's too hard, just go have a talk with God. When your load's too hard to bear, just go talk to God, He cares. So, that's just excerpted. But anyway, that played through my mind a lot. And I have to say, I really made a best friend out of Hashem. I talked to him a lot. And really asked for a lot of help and support, and really got a lot of help and support. And it's for sure hard to let go of a child, and I've really worked on my hashkafa over the years to know that Hashem granted him to us for a certain amount of time and trusted him into our care. For his sake, he needed us, and for our sake, we needed him. And I don't know all the reasons why. I don't. I see some of them unfolding already. I speak all around. I'm very privileged to do that. And a lot of people come over to me afterwards and say, could you speak to my aunt who just lost her child? Could you speak to my daughter who's been suicidal? Could you? I'm not going to make my life into suicide prevention. That's not me. My life is sharing Torah. And part of sharing Torah is dealing with people's deeper, darker parts that are real parts of them and need to be discussed and shared and supported. So I feel like, especially because my older kids who are the shidduch marrying type are married already, I could be straight up and honest. Just put it out there. There's such a thing as mental illness. Our community is not immune to it. We have it. It's difficult. A lot of people are suffering alone and silently. Somebody told me that you can compare and can't compare this generation's suffering with the suffering of the Holocaust. So we might say to ourselves, how do we compare? Like, we're not being chased. We live in lovely air-conditioned homes with plenty of food, good friends, closets stuffed with clothing. We're so comfortable in every way. How could we possibly compare? And yet, each one of us has our own private, really hard things. Health issues, or marital issues, or financial issues. And what makes it harder, in the generation of the Holocaust, at least people suffered together. And everybody was in the same terrible situation. Today, we're suffering alone. Each one afraid to talk to the other or thinking that nobody else understands them. And it makes it very hard to bear the burden of a mentally ill child or spouse or parent. I can't even tell you how many parents. The UPS guy came to our door, and of course my son, the computer geek, ordered computer pieces and parts regularly. So I wanted to tell him what happened. So I said that, you know, he took his own life and he's gone now. And he said, really? He said, he seemed so happy. I said, I know. He said, you know, my mother also took her own life. And she took my younger brother with her. And I felt, look what people are carrying. You know, like, nobody knows what people are carrying in their lives so much. You could always tell Hashem, right, for sure. Right. Not in the end. Yeah, for sure. He was brought up from. Stopped wearing his yarmulke in ninth grade. Probably stopped wearing since he's in eighth. But he reports not really feeling anything after sixth about. But he, again, he had a hard time in school. He was not, there were a lot of clashes between them. Yeah.
You want to wrap up this
meeting? Yeah. Yes. So I just want to give you a Yom Kippur thought. Okay, so it's a thought of from Sefer Yonah. So Yonah ben Amittai, that's his last name, ben Amittai. Right, so he's Yonah, the son of truth. And he gets really mad at Hashem by the end of the Sefer. And he yells at him. And he yells at him using a quote from Sefer Shmot. Remember what we say in Yom Kippur, Hashem, Hashem kel rachum v'chanun erach haim v'chesed v'emet. Right? So we say that again and again and again. But Yonah uses it to yell at Hashem. When the city is not destroyed, he says, Hashem, I can't stand it. I knew this was going to be a bad idea. I knew I should have given this nebuah. Because you are kel rachum v'chanun erach haim v'chesed v'emet. And there's the rest of the pasuk. Not emet. Nihum al hara. If you look in the pasuk and Yonah, Yonah ben Amittai is saying, you're not a God of truth. You're a God who changes your mind. You said you were going to overturn the city, and you didn't do it. And now I'm embarrassed, and I'm upset. I gave nevuah, and it didn't come true. You're a God that's Nihum al Havra. You just forgive people like that. Nihum al Havra. So that's how he yells at him, using that quote. So, and then there's the whole Kikayon ending, which is a very strange ending. Right? It ends with Hashem saying, you care about this plant that didn't exist and now does exist? Didn't exist and then did exist and now doesn't exist? And I shouldn't care about a city of 600,000 people and cattle? That's the end. And cattle? What kind of ending is that to the story? It's such a strange ending. So I learned from Rabbi David Foreman, sure it's based on a midrash somewhere, but I don't have that midrash in my head. He talks about Yonah's problem, is that he saw Hashem as only one-dimensional, which is a risk that we can have, seeing Hashem as one-dimensional, or even a few dimensions, but not seeing that Hashem is Ein Sof, has a lot of dimensions, and we can't access them all. So in Yonah's mind, he's thinking, Din, you judge people, they do something wrong, they should get punished. And you didn't punish them. Instead, you judged them with rachamim, right? You just said, oh, I'm going to be nishvisendik. You know that word in Yiddish? Nisht, not, visen, seeing, dik. You don't see. You turn a blind eye to something. You know, like sometimes you're, whatever, trying to talk on the phone and your toddler's unpacking your entire baking cabinet. You're going to be nishvisendik about that because usually you tell them not to, but you want to chat on the phone, right? Or sometimes a teenager is doing something that's on the edge, but it's not the argument you want to have with them. So you'll just be nishvisendik. So are we asking Hashem to be nishvisendik about our bad behavior? When we say, Hashem, please, get up off the kiseh haddin and judge us from the kiseh harachamim. Are we saying, please don't look at what I did and just be nice? Right? How could a Hashem of emet, how is that emistic? As a way to judge somebody. We could ask a friend to try to ignore our past. We can't ask Hashem who sees all and knows all to ignore a piece of us or a part of us or our history. But we do. So how is that emet? So it can be resolved by looking at the question of din and the question of rachamim. So if somebody is being judged through din, what is the question that din asks? Right. Justice says, what have you done? What have you done? And what do you deserve because of what you have done? Which is not the question that we want Hashem to ask of us. I mean, hopefully we'll do tshuva and we'll clean up everything. But let's say we don't clean it all up. We still don't want to be judged for what we've said, what we have skipped, what we shouldn't have done, what we should have done. There's so much. We don't really want Hashem to judge us on that. So we want Hashem to judge us with rachamim. So what is the question of rachamim? Rachamim, the root, is rechem. Right? So a rechem has a question. When a zygote, a fertilized egg, presents itself to the rechem has to ask, the rechem has to say, should I take you in or not? You know, one in four pregnancies end in miscarriage, and so early that you just think it's a period, right? So there's plenty of times when the rechem says, no, I don't think so. And how does the rechem make that decision, really, so to speak? It asks a question. It can't ask, what have you done? Because you've done nothing. There's no history to this newly fertilized egg. There's no past at all. It has to ask, based on the future, who can you become? Should I invest in you? Are you worth it? Do you have potential? Will you grow? Will you make me proud? Will you add to the world? Who can you become? And that's the way we want Hashem to judge us. To look not at what we've done, but who we could become. And the way that we can increase who we could become is through the tshuva process. When we take what we've done and do tshuva and flip it around, kapara means to flip something. Right? When we flip it from demerit to a merit, then it turns into rocket fuel. As bad as the Avera was, that's as much as chus as it could be, and you can really go far, your potential increases. It's not the only way. We shouldn't do Avera so we can increase our potential. Hashem fortunately arranges our lives so that there's lots of potential, but we could say to Hashem, please, I want to be your servant. I want to do your will. I want to get close to you. Please help me become great. Please help me become close to you. Please help me become who I could be. Please judge me with rachamim, see my potential, and help me get there. So with that, I'll just wrap up that we should take the hard parts of our lives and grow through them, and hopefully we'll see blossomings into good and strong and positive parts of our lives where we could reach inside ourselves, reach close to Hashem, reach outside of ourselves, and tie people in close with warmth and love and grow into an amazing, special, light-bearing nation for the entire world. That's what I'm sharing with you. Anybody who has to leave can leave, and anybody who has questions can stay. I have a website, just so you know, called abiteoftorah.com, where you could read stories, see some pictures of Donnie, but I have lots of audio on there too. It's all free. So lots of shiurim on different things if you want to listen to anything. A bite of Torah, a bite like a cookie. Abiteoftorah.com. So there's all kinds of interesting stuff on there. You want to hear a good Shidduch story? Whoever's in the Shidduch parsha? I have a really good story of my daughter Shidduch. It's a very special Shidduch.
Can't
you can't hear it now, but anyway, it's on there.
No, she could hear it. I was just making a joke.
She
can't leave now.
Oh, she can't leave now? Oh, I can't leave now. I'm not going to ruin the story by telling you 5 minutes. It's such a good story. Nope, you got to listen to the whole hour-long version. Go on my website and you'll see in Talks from Travels, or because unfortunately they did wait 4 years to have kids and then had twins in November and then lost one. I have a webpage for them too. There should have story, two different versions, one in London, which I took with Satmar Bikur Cholim. That was a pretty amazing experience. 1,000 Satmar women. They wanted me to tell a should have story without saying the word date or love. I was like, really? You flew me in to tell you a should have story? They're like, okay, fine, you can say date. So I have that version, or I have a more Hamish, like around the table version from Portland, Oregon. They're both on their webpage. Same story. So it's a good story. It's worth it to listen to. It's easy to listen in the car or whatever, but it's important.
That's on my Torah?
Yeah. I have a lot of audio. I have a lot of shiurim, but I have a whole page. I made a separate page. I have a page called Talks from Travels. So that's where I would post a talk like this, like a one-time talk to an audience I don't really know, but in different cities. So usually I give a little background, like this is a talk given to women, of strong Torah backgrounds. And sometimes I'll say this was a talk given to a mixed group in a JCC setting. So you just like kind of know who it's aimed at. But anyway, on that page is the Shidduch story also. Or you can have their whole own page. It's just interesting. So.
Thank you so much.